Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Family life and human dignity, including sex tourism and the degradation of women, are two of the topics covered in this week's edition of Joan Knows. First, however, Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett look at the Gospel for this Sunday, the 11th Sunday of Ordinary Time.
Jesus said to the crowd, "This is how it is with the reign of God. A man scatters seed on the ground. He goes to bed and gets up day after day. Through it all, the seed sprouts and grows without his knowing how it happens. The soil produces of itself, first the blade, then the ear, finally the ripe wheat in the ear. When the crop is ready, he wields the sickle, for the time is ripe for harvest." He went on to say, "What comparison shall we use for the reign of God? What image will help to present it? It is like mustard seed, which when planted in the soil is the smallest of all the earth's seeds, yet once it is sown, springs up to become the largest of shrubs, with branches big enough for the birds of the sky to build nests in its shade." By means of many such parables, he taught them the message in a way they could understand. To them he spoke only by way of parable, while he kept explaining things privately to his disciples.
Our Gospel today is part of the so-called Sermon of Parables, or rather of a group of parables which have been given the title Parables of the Kingdom. And four of these deal specifically with seeds: the parable of the sower, of the good seed growing together with the weeds, of the seed growing by itself, and of the mustard seed. We might wonder why Jesus used this image so often, and all on one occasion, when he was sitting in Peter's boat. For as Mark writes,
"He began to teach by the lakeside, but such a huge crowd gathered round him that he got into a boat and sat there. The people were all along the shore at the water's edge."
The opening of today's Gospel is a direct presentation of the kingdom, and the seed, writes a scholar, is the word of God. This little parable, he says, regards the inner strength of the growth of the kingdom. The parable of the mustard seed, he explains, emphasises the contrast between the humble, insignificant beginnings of the kingdom and its ability to grow up to a final, tremendous result. Accustomed as we are to hearing the parables read and explained, they don't strike us as being a particularly new way of presenting the gospel message. As a scholar writes, the parables are characteristic of the teaching of Jesus. But for the crowd listening to him that day by the lakeside, it was the first time they had heard him use them. "Quite suddenly, Jesus burst into parable," comments Sheed. "He seems to have uttered no parables earlier." The scholars explain.
Parable is the translation of the Hebrew mashal, or of the Aramaic matla, which has several meanings: similitude, allegorical story, metaphor, proverb, riddle. Parables are used also in the Old Testament and by the rabbis of the time of Jesus.
But whereas the parables used in the Old Testament were, as Sheed puts it, rudimentary sketches only, Jesus makes them live. Our biblical scholar comments,
"They are presented not so much as to illustrate a truth which is hard to understand by the use of images and situations taken from daily life, but so as to direct the listener to take a decision with regard to the message proclaimed by Jesus. Most of them are linked to the announcement of the kingdom of God as a totally new happening, which comes about with Jesus and in the face of which a stand must be taken. So the parable often recounts a single unusual event. It aims at involving the listener to discover a new reality and to take a decision. The parables must always be interpreted in their entirety, because the whole story converges on a decisive point. For this reason, the parables are distinct from allegories, where every narrative element has its own symbolic meaning."
We think of a parable as meaning simply a comparison. As Sheed comments, Jesus uses parable to illustrate spiritual truths by comparison with happenings in ordinary life. But, he stresses, they're always natural happenings.
The elements in the spiritual process are shown related to one another like the elements in the natural process. Our familiarity with the natural process helps us to familiarity with the spiritual.
That day of the first parables was an autumn day, probably late October or early November of the year 28 AD. And as in Palestine, sowing takes place in November after the first rains, it's hardly surprising that our Lord should have used the images he did. After recounting the parable of the sower, Jesus presents the image of the work of the earth, of the soil into which the seed has fallen and which will sprout and grow. And as Piero Bargellini comments,
there was, and there still is, something mysterious and surprising in the dark fermentation which under the earth by day and by night in the long winter months makes the thin green shoots sprout from the imprisoned seed, a fresh carpet for the fields in spring.
But however familiar this pattern is, it is ever new, ever surprising, how the miracle is repeated, and without our intervention. In the May of 1886, as the writer-naturalist Richard Jefferies lay dying, he expressed his almost childish amazement at how the natural world was getting on without him to note and record.
I wonder to myself how they can all get on without me. They manage, bird and flower, without me to keep the calendar for them. The seed leaves on the mound in the sheltered places that come so early, the pushing up of the young grass, the succulent dandelion, the coltsfoot on the heavy, thick clods, the trodden chickweed, despised at the foot of the gatepost. Day by day, a change. The moss drying on the tree trunks, dog's mercury stirring under the ash poles, bird's claw buds of beech lengthening. I cannot think how they manage without me. The green hawthorn buds prophesy on the hedge. The reed pushes up in the moist earth like a spear thrust through a shield. All these without me. How can they manage without me? Today, I have to listen to the lark's song, not out of doors with him, but through the window pane. And the bullfinch carries the rootlet fibre to his nest without me. They manage without me very well. They know their times and seasons. They go on without me.
Jefferies knew well that nature would manage without him, as nature always had, without man's intervention. But he was a dying man, and acute observer that he was, he knew what was happening out there, and able to see it no longer, was missing it desperately. Another writer of our own time, Peter Howard, records the slow progress underground of the seeds.
Seeds, bursting from their winter sleep, run their appointed hour to keep. They strive and thrust, they twist and run, to lift their hearts towards the sun. Seeds, in their silent winter bed, they lay as cold and still as dead. Beneath the stiff white sheets of frost, their bodies empty shells and lost. Beneath the deep, soft quilt of snow, they waited, row on sleeping row. And when the fingers of the thaw tapped gently at each hidden door, they stirred. The seeds no man can number, yet turned again to dark and slumber till the first trumpets of the sun tilted to heaven, afresh begun their song of spring. The seeds awoke, shook off their hard and heavy yoke of clay and stone, then, furrow-free, leapt to fulfill their destiny.
While Mark and Matthew write of seeds planted in a field, Luke, who only recounts the parable of the mustard seed, has the man throwing the seed into his garden. And this perhaps comes closer to our own experience. For many of us, seeds come in packets with glorious but unrealistic pictures of flowers on the front. For we are but amateur gardeners who dream the winter away, turning the pages of glossy catalogues. Muriel Stewart, however, went to the seed shop.
Here, in a quiet and dusty room, they lie, faded as crumbled stone or shifting sand, forlorn as ashes, shrivelled, scentless, dry, meadows and gardens running through my hand. Dead that shall quicken at the call of spring, sleepers to stir beneath June's magic kiss, though birds pass over unremembering, and no bee seeks here roses that were his. In this brown husk a dale of hawthorn dreams, a cedar in this narrow cell is thrust, that will drink deeply of a century's streams. These lilies shall make summer on my dust, here in their safe and simple house of death, sealed in their shells, a million roses leap. Here I can blow a garden with my breath, and in my hand a forest lies asleep.
Well, we may never plant a forest, nor even a mustard tree, but whatever seeds we put into the earth of our little plot, we put in with love and hope. And as Robert Frost wrote,
how love burns through the putting in the seed, on through the watching for that early birth, when, just as the soil tarnishes with weed, the sturdy seedling with arched body comes shouldering its way and shedding the earth crumbs.
There are many uses of the word seed, but surely one of the most curious is a sporting one, that referring to seeded tennis players. Dr. Brewer gives this concise explanation.
Those players regarded by the organisers of a tournament, for example, lawn tennis at the All England Club Wimbledon, as likely to reach the final stages, and who are so placed in the order of play that they do not meet each other until the closing rounds, these players are numbered in the order of likelihood. The allusion is to sowing seeds in such a way that those of the best plants are not weeded out before their time.
An earlier edition of Brewer has this laconic note.
Of course, it sometimes happens that seeded players are defeated early in a tournament.
Not that they have gone to seed, as a man may be unkindly described when he's lost his vigour or usefulness, or a plant that has produced its seeds and shed them. When we read the parable of the seed growing by itself in the darkness and silence of the earth, another meaning of the word comes to mind, now considered archaic, which in biblical use had the meaning of offspring or descendants. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, ran the old version of God's curse to the serpent in the Garden of Eden. And when a child is conceived, is it not from a seed? Which brings me to a very poignant poem, one of the most moving of those written in the First World War, and one of the saddest in our language, for it is without hope. When I read it, I think of the writer's mother, and wonder, did she murmur those lines to herself on Armistice Day, November the 11th, 1918, when, as all the bells were ringing in celebration of peace, she received the telegram informing her that her son Wilfred, aged 25, had been killed in action the previous week. Here now is Wilfred Owen's Futility.
Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once, at home, whispering of fields unsown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clays of a cold star. Our limbs so dear achieved, our sides full-nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Or what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all?
A recent biographer suggests that this poem referred to one of Wilfrid's companions, who died of exposure in January 1918. He writes,
Wilfrid and his platoon had no shelter except the slight rise in the ground ahead of them. They lay out on the burning snow under a lethal wind, unable to move by daylight and unable even to drink because their water cans were frozen.
Wilfrid apparently managed to sleep for a while, but when he woke up, he thought he was dead and in hell. He himself records, "One of my party actually froze to death." And he wrote another poem called Exposure, recording this experience. Tertullian wrote of the Christian martyrs, "As often as we are mown down by you, the more we grow in numbers. The blood of Christians is the seed." Traditionally, this is quoted always as, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." These young men may not have been martyrs, but as the saying had it at the time, half the seed of Europe died in the First World War. Our Christian belief teaches us that unless the grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And now let's listen to some light-hearted lines on a serious subject.
This day, relenting God hath placed within my hand a wondrous thing, and God be praised, at his command, seeking his secret deeds with tears and toiling breath, I find thy cunning seeds, O million murdering death. I know this little thing of myriad men may save. O death, where is thy sting, thy victory, O grave?
In those lines, Sir Ronald Ross was writing of his part in the discovery of the life cycle of the malaria parasite. And now to the seeds of our parables, writes Piero Bargellini.
Mustard seed was proverbial throughout the East for its tiny size. The plant, by contrast, grew bigger than all other herbs. In Palestine, mustard plants grew to a height of 3 or 4 metres and had a woody trunk, like a real tree.
Mustard is known for giving an edge to the food it accompanies, hence the phrase for an enthusiastic person is keen as mustard. And the Romans named the herb from mustus, the new wine they mixed with the seed, and ardens for fiery. Sadly, it has also been used for cruel purposes, as with the invention of mustard gas in the First World War. But let's close with these thoughts of Bargellini on the seed growing silently.
There's no need for us to be farmers, to have seen with our own eyes the marvel, ever renewed, of the miracle of that grass which becomes stalk and ear, of the ear which forms grains and ripens, bended down, then golden on the stem. So the grain grows, and so does the kingdom of God in souls. The seed is sown, and it only needs the soil to be ready to welcome it. The rest comes about not because of our care, nor to our merit. The same force which makes the new harvest sprout from the seed is that which makes men ripe for the great reaping.
Now for a visit to the Vatican as Joan Lewis and I look at some of this week's events. Joan, here we go again.
You know, and in looking back at the news to prepare for today's show, at least in overview, it was a very, very quiet week. And actually, what did the Pope, what was he involved in directly? It was only two things with the public, and that was the Angelus and yesterday's general audience. There was a telegram for the death of an Italian soldier. and something like that. But actually, the Pope's actual appearances being with the public were only those two events. But two interesting things in the Vatican really were, as the whole planet knows, the World Cup began in Germany. The World Cup soccer football champion began in Germany on June 9th. And just a day before the start of the Soccer Cup, we had Archbishop Agostino Marchetto, who's from the Pontifical Council for Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, if you will. And he denounced reports that had been flowing out from various sources that 40,000 women, mostly from like Southeastern Europe and Eastern European countries, would be brought to Germany for the month-long games to work as prostitutes. And he said, you know, I mean, this is nothing other than a modern form of slavery. And he said, to use what are football terms, I'd like to hand out a few red cards to the customers, to the sports industry, and to public authorities. And of course, red cards for those six or seven people who are not familiar with soccer. Red cards are used in football, or soccer as it's called in the United States, to expel a player for a game when they've committed a serious foul, violent conduct, or used offensive or insulting language. So that's what he meant when he said he'd like to give out red cards. And he said, and it's so true, prostitution violates the dignity of a human person. And women have just become market commodities for so many who can be bought at the cost of a ticket to a game. The reason, really, that the Archbishop denounced it, I mean, anybody, obviously, in the Vatican could have and should have, but his council has approached this question on at other times because they have treated in a number of international meetings that they go to the question of sex tourism. And as a matter of fact, the very last time they did it was at the 6th World Congress for the Pastoral Care of Tourism, which was held in Bangkok, Thailand in 2004. And we know there is an awful lot of sex tourism in Bangkok, too. So that was a very interesting message. And in a way, maybe it was good that it was a very quiet week because the Archbishop's message, instead of getting lost maybe among a lot of other messages or events in the week, I mean, it was noticed by a lot of the world's press, in particular secular press. And then on June 9th, we said, of course, when the World Cup began, on that day there was another message. It was from Cardinal Angelo Sodano, of course, Secretary of State, to participants in the 36th General Assembly of the Organization of American States. And that had closed that meeting just a few days earlier. But he did send a message in the Pope's name, so I guess we can say the Pope did have something else on his agenda that week, which focused on the dignity of human beings and the absolute value of human life from conception to natural end. And the essence of the message, to distill it in a few words, was that he was talking to member states of a continent that was known for such a long time, a long tradition, as he said, of respecting life. And now pressure is being put by different groups on the populace of the various Latin American countries that are actions, opinions, contrary to what the Church has always taught about defending life and protecting and promoting the family, of course, based on marriage between a man and a woman. And then the cardinal did bring out the fact that he said another priority is to favor conditions that reduce violence. This all has to do with human dignity, that reduces violence in its various forms: terrorism, attacks on innocent civilians, and attacks on the family. So a very important message, and those were the big things out of the Vatican, except, of course, the Vatican did release the Pope's schedule for his trip to Spain. And he's going to Valencia in July 8 and 9 to conclude the 5th World Meeting of Families. And I guess the whole world, or certainly the Vatican and Spain, better pray that Italy and or Spain are not in the finals of the World Cup. We will begin our talk and end our talk on the World Cup because it's being played on July 9th, which is, of course, actually it'll probably be played in the evening and the Pope's Mass to conclude the 5th World Meeting of Families will take place in the morning. He'll be back in Rome safely. He either leaves or arrives at 3:30. So he's going to meet, interestingly enough, just one little parenthesis. The Pope will meet with the King and Queen of Spain. He will go to the City Hall to meet them. He will also meet with the Prime Minister, but the Prime Minister is going to have to come to the Pope. And he will be, I think, at the Nunciatur at that time. And, of course, you've got a lot of problems between friction between the government and the church since Zapatero's election.
And now for our question.
This question came from a listener who emailed from the page, which many of you know that the web page no longer exists. Let me just tell you right now, if you have a question, the email address is joanknows@gmail.com. So this question came to that from the internet page previously, who a woman has a 13-year-old son who wants to attend Catholic school. She's thrilled. He was baptized in her husband's family church, a congregational Armenian church, had his first Holy Communion in New York at St. Patrick's Church Catholic, which accepted this congregational baptism. The school, Catholic school he wants to attend in California, is not accepting the baptism. She thought all Catholic churches followed the same set of rules. Is that not correct? And I had a theologian, because it's not my expertise, I had a theologian answer this, and he said the answer would depend on the specifics of the baptism. Unless there's a reason to doubt validity, the baptism of mainstream Protestant churches is accepted by the church. If there is a doubt, the pastor can ask how it was performed. If it was performed by pouring water on the head or by immersion or with the Trinitarian formula, it is then valid. So then this theologian listed a couple of possibilities that could be, should we call it, a deviation of that format. If it took place, the baptism, in a church whose theology is not Christian, and which therefore, even with water and the Trinitarian form, would not have the Orthodox Christian meaning. So that would be a possibility. Make sure your pastor knows the precise circumstances of the baptism. I won't go into all of the possibilities just for time constraints, but the woman to whom I'm speaking today should find out the reason why the second priest that she talked to says the baptism is not valid. What is his reason? And then she should go and get the answer to his possible reason or objection. And then, interestingly enough, he said if there is a legitimate concern about validity, the boy should be conditionally baptized. So I will send our listener from California, who can't hear the show right now, and so I will be sending you, if a friend of yours is listening, shall we say, I will send this answer also via email. But keep them coming. joanknows@gmail.com.
You have been listening to Jill Bevilacqua, Sean Patrick Lovett, and to me, Sister Janet Ferns. You can hear us all again at the same time next week or at your leisure through the internet by going to vaticanradio.org and clicking on English. Until we meet again, may God bless you.